Okay. I think we're close enough now. And so I'm going to start the word of the Buddha. And so I'll just hope we can all do the Namo Tassa together, because this is, again, this is the Buddha's teachings, and we always give that extra respect. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. So I did just it makes sense to me, just a very brief introduction to the third noble truth. So I'm just going to go over it from the beginning. The noble truth of the cessation of suffering. Can you hear okay? Good. This is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting. Wanting related to the five senses, wanting for existence, and wanting not to be. The giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, never letting it settle enough to grow. And last time I just mentioned those four Pali words, that is Patinissaka, Chaga, Muti, and Analiya. And the Patinissaka is literally like throwing things away. Jaga is like giving, expecting nothing back in return. And Muti is this idea of freedom. And I describe that as wherever you are, you're happy to be here. And lastly, Analiya, whatever occurs to you in life, just allowing it to be like your mind to be like a Teflon mind, nothing sticks to it. As soon as it settles, it disappears straight away. And then Buddha continues, wherever in the world there is anything agreeable and pleasurable, there the cessation of wanting comes about. And what is there in the world that is agreeable and pleasurable? Sight in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. Hearing, smell, taste, touch, and knowing is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting comes to be abandoned. There a cessation comes about. And what? Can you see it okay? Whatever spiritual seekers in the past regarded pleasant and agreeable things in the world as impermanent, as suffering, as non-self, as an affliction, as fearful, they abandoned wanting. Now that's what we discussed last time, so I'm just going to continue on here. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting, tanha. Tanha, as you all know, means thirst. Often it's translated as craving. The idea of craving is just a bit too strong or wanting. Even small bits of wanting also are included in this second and third noble truth. With the fading away of that same wanting comes cessation of fuel. This is dependent origination. The upadana literally means taking up. With the cessation of fuel, cessation of states of existence. With the cessation of states of existence, cessation of rebirth. Cessation of rebirth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, unhappiness, and distress cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. This is the passing away of suffering. The cessation, subsiding, and passing away of form, of experience, that's Vedana, of perception, of will, of consciousnesses. It's a cessation of suffering, the subsiding of affliction, the passing away of aging and death. Just, that's a powerful statement there. I'm not sure if last week or 2 weeks ago I emphasized that enough. I had to be careful in English. I never use the word stressed, because that's always got a bad implication. Emphasize has a good implication. So to emphasize, the cessation, subsiding and passing away of form, of Vedana, of perception, of sankhara, of consciousnesses, is the cessation of suffering. the subsiding of affliction, the passing away of aging and death. And now, very many people like to discuss Nibbana, and of course, in the suttas, as the Buddha described it, describe two types of Nibbana. Nibbana with residue remaining, this is Sat-parisesa Nibbana, and At-parisesa Nibbana, without anything remaining. So the first of all, Nibbana with residue remaining. This is peaceful, this is sublime, that is the stilling, samatha, of all will, sankhara, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of wanting, fading away, cessation, nibbana. That's peaceful, sublime, when these things get so still that there's no will left. Relinquishing of all acquisition, destruction of wanting, fading away, cessation, nibbana. When excited by wanting, overcome by wanting, when full of aversion, overcome by aversion, when deluded, overcome by delusion, with mind obsessed by these, you intentionally create problems for yourself, for others, or for both, and you experience mental suffering and depression. But when wanting, aversion, and delusion are abandoned, you do not intentionally create any problems for yourself, for others, or for both, and you do not experience mental suffering and depression. It is in this way that Nibbana can be experienced directly. The destruction of wanting, the destruction of aversion, the destruction of delusion, this is called Nibbana, with residue remaining. Oh my goodness. So that's Nibbana with residue remaining. What do you really mean by that? When a person becomes fully enlightened, an arahat, a Buddha, then do they just disappear? They vanish? You say the defilements, the greed, hatred, delusion, wanting, all of that has been destroyed, but the five khandhas still continue on. That's a nibbana with the five khandhas remaining. And of course, there comes a time when that enlightened being passes away, when the Buddha experiences what they call parinibbana. And anyone who knows your pari knows that pari means complete, full, total. It is nibbana with not just things like wanting disappearing, but also all the five khandhas disappearing. If one is intent on the end of wanting and clarity of mind, when one sees the arising of any of the six senses, one's mind is completely free from wanting. For one of peaceful mind, one completely liberated, there's nothing further to be done. No need to increase what has been done. As a stone mountain, one solid mass, is not stirred by the wind, so no sights, sounds, odors, tastes, touches, or mind objects, desirable or undesirable, stir the stability of the mind. The mind is steady and freed, and you witness the vanishing of the mind. That's a beautiful statement. This comes very clear in everything else which is said in a few moments. The vanishing of the mind. And one who has considered all the contrasts on this earth and is no more disturbed by anything whatever in this world, the peaceful one, freed from rage, from frustration and from wanting, the stream of consciousnesses will not be reborn. And this is again one of my favorite little passages about the bhikkhuni who was enlightened called Vajira. And Mara, in this story from the suttas, comes up to Vajira and says to her, "By whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of this being? Where has this being arisen? And where does this being cease?" And the Bhikkhuni Arahat Vajira replied, "Why now do you assume a being, Mara? Is that your wrong view? This is a heap of sankharas. Here no being is found. Just as with a coming together of parts, the word vehicle is used, so when the five components of existence exist, there is the conventional term of being." And this is a powerful statement. It is only dukkha, suffering, that comes to be. Dukkha that stands, and dukkha that falls away. Nothing but dukkha comes to be. Nothing but dukkha ceases. An arahat understands that the six senses, this is from the Samyutta, an arahat understands that the six senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and the mind, will cease completely and totally without remainder, and no other senses would arise anywhere in any way. This is another way one knows that there is nothing more to be done for an arahat. That's one of the most clear and powerful statements of the wisdom of an arahat, and knowing that all the senses, the six senses, will totally cease and not be, not arise anywhere in any way. And I left that to the end of the third noble truth, the end of suffering. Questions, comments, complaints? Yes.
Sometimes you have the mind consists of two parts. There is the knower and then the condition of the mind. When you say about this mind, what does it, which one are you referring to?
It's that difference is not recognized in Theravada Buddhism. We have the mind, and the mind is a sense which can know its own objects. It is the sixth sense, and it has no essential being which lasts forever. Please bear with us, because when we get into the next of these noble truths, the way leading to cessation of suffering, and it goes into right view, you'll find that it's described quite clearly what the mind is and how we can get deluded about the nature of the mind. So can you bear with me with that question, and the answer will become much clearer in a few moments. If it doesn't become clearer, put up your hand again. Anyway, the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering, the fourth noble truth. There are two extremes that should be avoided: the pursuit of happiness through the five senses, and I'll just point out there, through the five senses. That is an accurate translation. It's explained later on in things like the Non-Conflict Sutta and Ranavibhanga Sutta, and it's very clear here, it's Kama Sukhali Kanu Yoga, and that always refers to the five senses. There's an interesting point there. There are these two extremes that should be avoided: the pursuit of happiness with the five senses, which is low, hina, secular, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial. You see, I think we've got the same text here. When it says lo, hina, that's where we get the word hinayana from. Hinayana is not an inferior vehicle, and it certainly should never describe anyone as practicing the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path, Buddhists. Hina means low, despicable. It's actually quite a derogatory word. And I remember just, I still got the paperwork somewhere in my room, when I wrote to the Oxford English Dictionary to complain about them using the word Hinayana as an equivalent for Theravada. And we know with all of the details from as many Pali and Sanskrit dictionaries as I could muster to say that Hina is actually derogatory. And please excuse me, but it's like, you know, calling an African sort of a nigger. It's a very bad word. So if you look up in any dictionary the meaning of the word Hina, you know, should never really be used. And actually they took it on board, which was great. And so now in the Oxford English Dictionary, if you get a reasonably modern one, not sort of 20 years old, you'll find there that it's said to be a derogatory word to be avoided. Anyway, and the pursuit of practices that fatigue the body and the mind. And I love that way of like fatigue calls tiredness, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. Without going to either of these extremes, the Buddha has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, to wisdom, leads to peace, to direct understanding, to enlightenment, to nirvana. It is this noble eightfold path, right view, right motivation, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right endeavor, right mindfulness, and right stillness. Now, those of you who haven't heard me before can notice a few different translations you may have been used to before, because some of those old translations are not that accurate. Those old translations were started by Professor Rhys Davids over 100 years ago, and you know, he did amazingly well to get some of these very accurate. You know, like right, well, right view is pretty obvious. The right mindfulness came from him, and you got to give him more credit for that. When it comes to the second factor of the Eightfold Path, and it's called Sama Sankhapa, to talk to that about right thought or right intention, that both of those don't really fit. Intention is where you are aiming for. Thought is a hindrance to the path. It's not a part of the path. And so when it comes to the meaning of Sankhapa, there are three explanations to Samasankhapa, and that is, was in a not Patti Nisaga. What is it? It's renunciation. Nekama, thank you. It's like Nekama Sankhapa, Avayapada Sankhapa, and Ahimsaka Sankhapa. And when you understand the meaning of those words, it's not what you're aiming for, it is where you're coming from. You're coming from actions of body, speech, and mind, which are coming from renunciation, coming from kindness, which is the meaning of avayapada, without hatred. The opposite meaning there in Pali does mean something positive, loving kindness and gentleness. So that's why much prefer, and I can argue with you about it, that to have right motivation, where you're coming from. Speech, action, livelihood, fair enough. Samawayama, to call that right effort, again, makes no sense to me, simply because when you put forth effort in your meditation, you don't get any peace. You have to let go of the effort. As I've said to many monks in many talks, the effort stops when you get on your meditation cushion. When you let go of the will, you don't enhance the will. And then from that right endeavor, that's one of the translations, I'm still not settled on that, I must admit. Sometimes these days I prefer right restraint. Then right mindfulness, brilliant. And the last one, of course, you've heard me so many times, Samma Samadhi. To call that right concentration is just so counterproductive. If you try to make the mind still, you try and concentrate it, you get far too tense. But stillness is a much, much, much more effective, better translation of the word samadhi. That is the middle way awakened to by the Buddha, which gives rise to vision, to wisdom, leads to peace, to direct understanding, to enlightenment, nibbana. Okay, and here we go from the Rana Vibhanga, Majjhima 139. The pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, low, secular, coarse, ignoble, unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. It is the wrong way. Disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, low, secular, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, we're talking about the pleasures of the five senses there, is a state without suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. It is the right way. So instead of pursuit of the pleasure, the disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure, that is a state without suffering. Frustration, despair, and fever, it is the right way. And this is one of the statements which I often often state, this is from the Dhammapada. The Noble Eightfold Path is the best of all practices. Eso wa mago nati anyo dasanasa visuddhiya. This is the only path for purifying insight. There is no other. Eso wa mago nati anyo. I don't know any of you know Pali here, but that's so clear. This is the only path for purifying insight, there is no other. Follow this path and you will confuse Mara. And of course the word I put up there, discombobulate. That's just Ajahn Brahm just having a bit of fun with one of my favorite English words. Listen, the end of dying has been reached. Now, sometimes people translate this, listen, the deathless has been reached. And straight away, if I translated it as the deathless, people start to think, oh, this is an amazing state, which is like beyond suffering, but you still exist there somewhere. And just calling it, listen, the end of dying has been reached, which is a really good translation. It gives a totally different meaning, which is consistent with everything else which the Buddha has been teaching. Listen, the end of dying has been reached. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma. Practicing as you are instructed by realizing for yourself in this very life through direct understanding, you will soon enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which people rightly go forth into monastic life. That's kind of the introduction to the Fourth Noble Truth. And then we go into the Eightfold Path. But before I go further, any questions which you have? Eddie? Or Ananda first?
Ajahn, you mentioned that on that Samma Vayama, your translation, Of course I think it's an improvement on the right effort. Would you say, I think in one of your Dhamma pieces, you used the word right outlook.
Outlook. Not on Samma Vayama. It should be like right restraint. It's like a not doing rather than a doing. Yeah. Ability to restrain, to give up, to renounce, not to do. So it's an effort not to make effort.
It's the four sampapadana, isn't it? The four.
Yes, yeah.
Yes.
That's right, those four, which is about any unpleasant thing which is in the mind, to be able to know a way of, you know, getting rid of all unpleasant things. You don't get rid of unpleasant things through fighting them or not wanting them. Remember that simile of the monster who came into the empress's palace. Everyone tried to get rid of the monster, but every unkind act, unkind deed, unkind word, that monster grew an inch bigger and more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. That's now from the Yaka Samyutta. And so when the empress came back, she said, she knew what to do. She said, welcome. Welcome, monster. Thank you for coming here. She used metta, loving kindness. And the monster just shrank inch by inch until one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. That's so how we get rid of things, you know, who invade our mind. It's so beautiful kindness and renunciation, yes? Sorry?
Sorry, Ajahn. If one's outlook is generally on geared towards those four sampapadana, and it is grounded in things like metta, then that outlook will help mindfulness and the stillness.
Indeed, I think that what you're meaning there is that once you have the right view. When you have the right view, and you see there's nothing in here, you know what suffering is, and you know that the job of practice is to let go of that suffering, and so everything, all your sense activity stops, then that conditions the samasankapa, the right motivation. You're motivated because of your right view. Once that motivation is pure, then your speech, action, livelihood also becomes pure. And once those things become pure, then the sense restraint comes even deeper in. Once that sense restraint comes in, then you find that you can practice satipatthana, your mindfulness increases in power. You've done what is called vinaya loke abhijja dhammanasa. You've restrained the five hindrances. And once those things are restrained, your mindfulness increases to the point you can get stillness. In other words, the deep meditations of jhana. And from there, the understanding comes of liberation. So it's a restraint, and one thing leads to the other. So the outlook is more to do with right view. I don't know if it convinces you, but that's my answer.
No, that's a good answer, Ajahn. But what I thought was that in that sutta like Mahachatarisika Sutta, that it always says that right view and sammaditti, samma vayama and samma sati, these three are always together.
Yes.
And that they are the ones that lead the other five factors.
I don't think you can really say that, and I think that's probably the bad translation. If I remember correctly, that in that sutta, they do also say that there is a difference of alokya and aloka factors of the Eightfold Path.
Yes, it is. Yes, they differentiate that sutta differentiates that.
And that doesn't make any sense at all, but it's also that differentiation only applies if you read that sutta to the first five factors of the Eightfold Path. There is no distinction at all between lokya and aloka for right samma vayama, samma sati, or samma samadhi.
It does say that, and towards the end of that sutta, it does say that.
It says there is no distinction. That
no distinction, yes.
Yeah, sorry?
It does say that it is the lokottara samadhi is the path of the factor, factor of the path.
Yes,
but path factor. It says path factor.
But they don't have that distinction, Lokutra and Loki, and what's the other one? And Lokiya, for the last three factors of the path.
Yes, yes. So it does say that.
If you read that, that comes out quite strongly. And even the first part of it, there's many of us monks, we look at those, that distinction there and think that does really sound like an influence of later teachings into that particular sutta.
Yes. Yes, I think.
Because now how can you say that right view is even Lokiya? Never can say that. And especially when you get to things like, you know, samadhi. Sama samadhi is always defined as four jhanas. And if ever you've experienced any one of those states, it's impossible to regard those as Lokiya. You can never do that. How can you regard Satipatthana as Lokiya? It's not there. Okay, let's have another question. Okay, you got Eddie first and then Sue.
Ajahn Brahm, can you just scroll backwards just a little bit for right view? Can you do that?
I can't, but they can.
Oh, okay. Who can do it? Just a little bit. Sorry, then you can, if I tell you, yeah, a bit more, just a little bit. Okay. Okay, if you read here, okay, just here, disengage.
Oh, yeah.
It's the middle way here.
Disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure.
Disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses. Low, circular, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. A state without suffering, frustration, despair, and fear, and it is the right way. So based on this thing, it's the extreme, you know. Where does the middle, earlier you said about the middle way.
Yes.
It's a middle way. And sometimes if they should be sticking to one, sometimes they say, oh, middle way is the avoiding the extremes.
Yes, and it's okay, those extremes.
That's what I always think, you know. But then sometimes they say, oh, you know, pursuit of pleasure brings to suffering. But yes, that's the extreme.
No.
Do you see what I mean?
I see what you mean, but what I'm saying is, or what the Buddha is also saying, I would maintain, is that where you put extremes, the Buddha says quite clearly where the middle way really is, and where he puts that middle way is disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure linked to the five senses. That is one of the extremes. If you disengage from the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, you find that you pursue the pleasure linked to the sixth sense, the mind. That is the middle way.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But my version, sorry, of middle way is, if you tune the guitar string too much, it will snap. If you leave it too loose, it will play. That's what I always thought, you know.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But if you leave it too loose, and you don't know just the right amount to tighten it, which is no for a string, it's not making it snap, it's leaving it so loose, when something hits it, it doesn't make any sound at all. Because the job is not to make music, but to make peace. So this is how the Buddha is describing it. And that makes the most beautiful music you can experience with the senses, which is the delight of the mind. Okay, Sue. Okay. Yeah.
Does that then apply to anyone who becomes enlightened who doesn't die?
Correct.
Yeah. And then Parinibbana would be the disintegration of the final...
five khandhas, yeah. So that's when what people say death is. But sometimes that some people don't call it death for an enlightened being because it's more powerful than just death. It may look like death to other people, but to an enlightened being, it's just the cessation of things. And we prefer the cessation. We'll come across this simile later on here, if we have enough time. It's a simile of the fire going out, the flame. You can't say the flame dies. It's not annihilated. The causes for the flame, the wood, the heat, is all used up. So the flame just ceases. We never called it dying. Ceases. This is where good old Bill gets lots of exercise. He's in training for the next Olympics.
Ajahn Brahm, I'd like to ask, I recall reading a sutta where the Buddha was asked, he was talking about sitting in, a man was asking him about how it is to sit in the middle of the forest, that the rumble of the trees was frightening to that man. And the Buddha says, no, the sound is thrilling. Doesn't that also sound a bit like enjoying pleasure of nature, or the enjoying, like, you know, you would the ocean surf or a little bit like that?
Yeah. The Buddha say it could be thrilling because sometimes people just like the excitement. That's one of the reasons why they go bungee jumping, they go on fast motorbikes. But again, the best, he also said, unless you know that stillness of the mind, people who go into the forest go mad. They go crazy. But if you can let that sound disappear and go, that's real stillness, not the sound of silence. No sound left at all. Real stillness. Those five senses vanish, then that is always the best. It's not thrilling, it's satisfying.
Here it says, you witness vanishing of the mind.
Oh good, I'm glad you noticed that one, yes.
Is that Nirodha Samapatti or something like
that? Yes, something like that. I don't know exactly remember what it really is, but that's I think it's like, when I said the mind, it must be the jitta vanishing. But that is going to come up again if we have the time. Let's see how far it is, and I'll just, let's even go a bit further. I don't mind just going a bit further down here. Oh, goodness. I can't find it. Let's see. It's in here somewhere. Give me a little bit more time. Okay. Now what I was looking for, I have it down here, but it's only a minor. Okay, it's page 25. You got it there? It would be better for... Now you've gone too far. We've got the different page numbers. I thought we had the same one here. The top of page 25. Above wise complex. Please go, keep going up. I'll see if I can see it. Keep going up. Okay, just above wise contemplations. There. Stop. This is one of those lovely statements. It would be better for the uninstructed worldling to take as this soul, this body, rather than the mind. Why? Because his body lasts for up to 100 years or even longer. But that thing that is called mind, or mentality, or consciousness, arises as one thing and ceases as another all the time. The vanishing of the mind. Mind is not something which is stable. And that's the second thing which from that little quote there is the way the Buddha writes it in the grammar of Pali, that thing, singular, that is called by some people mind, citta, by some people as mentality, mano, that's the sense, the sixth sense, or consciousness, vijnana. We give that same thing different names. And that's why the grammatic there, they use the word va, which means or. It arises as one thing and ceases as another all the time. It's not permanent. There's not an essence in there. So even there you can see the vanishing of the mind. Arising as one thing, ceasing as another. Okay, now where was I? Okay, got another question over there.
Ajahn, could you explain a little bit more about arising as one and departing as another?
Okay, in other words, just how consciousness comes to be. Sometimes it arises as mind consciousness, sometimes it arises as sight consciousness, sometimes arises as hearing consciousness, from all the six different types of senses. That's why I called it consciousnesses. It arises as one thing, fades away as something else. Different things. And it's one of the insights you have, just to make that statement that the thing we call vijnana, sixfold, six different types of vijnana, to deal with the six different senses which we have. And even the consciousness, we always call it the same word, consciousness, but it's a different character. Mind consciousness is totally different than sight consciousness, which is totally different than sound consciousness. But what happens with a human being is you see something and then the mind kicks in, it knows you saw something. And then you may hear something, and then the mind kicks in and you know you've heard. A lot of times you may hear something, the mind doesn't kick in at all. In other words, you don't know afterwards. As much information goes into your brain and your mind, actually into your brain, which the mind doesn't engage with at all. How many feelings have you got in your body right now? They're still here, but now you're paying attention to me, so you're not really aware of them. So this is what the Buddha means. One moment you're aware of what I'm saying. Next moment you're aware of what you're thinking. Next moment you're aware of, you know, your bottom is hurting or something. And this is all those different consciousnesses. Arises as one thing, passes away as another, constantly changing. And it's one of the jobs to understand what mind consciousness is, more than anything else. And then you can actually separate the different consciousness experiences. I don't know if that makes sense at all. Okay, good. Thank you. M-A-N-O.
Yeah.
Yes, for mano, it is usually the word which people use for the sense base of mind. Mano vijnana. M-A-N-O. Yeah. It's just like trying to categorize these things in terms of sense basis. Like, you know, chaku vijnana. But the sixth one is mano vijnana. Yeah. So they use sometimes mano vijnana. And the point here, when the Buddha makes these statements, it makes them a couple of times. What the Buddha says is mano, or so what people say is mano or citta or vijnana. How do people, you know, call the sense of self or soul or heart or mind? Even we use different words for it. So the Buddha is saying this is not like a legal document where each one of these words has a specific definition. He's dealing with the way that people talk about these things. What people say, talk about, think as the word in Pali, vijnana. Or sometimes they're pointing to the same thing, but they call it citta. Or they're pointing to the same thing, and they call it mano. Different ways which people interpret and then call. That's what perception does, it gives things a name. And then that is what the same thing they're pointing to. That's why it says that singular, which they call these things, arises as one thing, ceases as something else, all the time.
So in this case, it would be the consciousness that knows concepts.
It's just the consciousness, whatever you call it. Like sometimes, what people try and assign the term like a soul or a self to. Now, who are you? And, you know, you say the body, you know, it's pretty simple to see that will pass away. Hasn't passed away yet. So you're going to expect the dissolution of your body. It hasn't happened yet. Maybe you're the first one who doesn't die. Some people say that. But nevertheless, you know, it's pretty obvious to know that your body is not going to be permanent. Your sights, hearing, smell, taste, touch. But the idea of the mind ceasing as well. What is the mind? And that's whatever you call that mind, that knowing, that experiencer, whatever you call it, so many different names you can give it.
So is mano a kind of one of the collective terms, a bit like nama?
Yeah, no, not behind nama. It's one of those terms. And people sometimes, in the West sometimes they call it your heart, your essence. And we always have so many different names for what we think is like the ground of all being, the essence, the cosmic consciousness, that which unites us all or something. Whatever you call it. That which is the knowing, if you like. That's another word.
That's what, because it's used in the first Dhammapada, isn't it? Mano pubangama dhamma.
Yes.
That one, it's like mind, that one, whatever mano is, precedes all things. But the way you're saying, like vijnana, you know, chakku, vijnana for the eye, vijnana for the ear, vijnana for the tongue, you know, that's very specific and very categorically, like, clear. But mano seems pretty general now.
Yeah, it seems general. But this is just the way that people use those words. Like even now, I'm trying to point out that even today people use these words in so many different meanings. So the Buddha was trying to embrace all of these meanings. Put them all together, what you call mano, what you call vijnana, what you call citta, whatever you call these things. Yeah?
Ajahn, a person on the path to Nibbana, we call entering the stream. What actually enters the stream, if it is the mind or the mano, if arises and passes away and arises and passes, what maintains the continuity of that?
It is the process comes to an ending. You know, what happens, you know, to the flame when the fuel is exhausted? What actually dies? Can't even say the flame dies. It just, the causes cease, and then the result ceases. This whole purpose of dependent origination and dependent cessation. When the causes cease, the effect ceases. And for entering the stream, unless it's seeing the non-self, really seeing it, understanding it, and then that causes a weakening of the process. It's like you're driving a car and you run out of fuel. Does the car stop immediately? You have the momentum, and that just carries you for up to 6 more lifetimes if you've been traveling very fast. Otherwise, you can stop pretty quickly. But you don't say it's something which enters the stream. It's just the stream has lost its source of water. It's going to dry up.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Okay. Okay, yes.
So the mind consciousnesses, no matter how beautiful they are, and no matter how bright or glorious or lovely or happy they are, they're subject to movement, aren't they?
They're subject to movement. And this is one of those experiences you have when you get to intense states of blissful mind states. Again, the jhanas. Many people experience, say, a first jhana, and they think they're enlightened, or they have union with God, bliss. But then they find that there's another second jhana, and that blows your mind. Seeing the first jhana was enough to blow your mind, but then you see there's more of this, and you kind of wonder what else is there. And every one of these jhana experiences, they are the that sixth sense alone getting more and more refined, more and more still, and then disappearing. And this weird thing is the most beautiful states are still suffering. There's another one after it which is more beautiful. And that is, okay, we're going to go over this, the Yamaka Sutta, which is, he's over there, here somewhere. I'm going to teach this because this is beautiful. So, this is on page, what is it? Oh, okay. That's Kamaka. Where's the Yamaka gone? Here we go. I've got it on page 29 somewhere. Just before dependent origination. Okay, here we go. Okay, go up a bit more. No, just before, you got the start of Yamaka, but it starts before that. You can see Samyutta 22.85. No, you've gone too far. There we go, that's it, there we go. Now this is one of my favourite suttas. What do you think, Yamaka? Asked Sariputta. Yamaka was a monk, and of course you all know Sariputta was the wisest disciple of the Buddha. What do you think, Yamaka? Asked Sariputta. Do you regard the body, experience, vedana, perception, will, or consciousnesses as an enlightened one? No, Venerable. Do you regard an enlightened one as without the body, the enlightened one as within the body, as within experience, as within perception, as within will, or within consciousnesses? No, Venerable. Do you regard an enlightened one as separate from the body, as separate from experience, as separate from perception, as separate from will, or as separate from consciousnesses? No, Venerable. Do you regard the body, experience, perception, will, and consciousnesses taken together as an enlightened one? No, Venerable. Do you take an enlightened one as one who is without form, without experience, without perception, without will, without consciousnesses? No, Venerable. But, Yamaka, when an enlightened one is not apprehended by you as real and actual here in this very life, is it fitting for you to declare that an enlightened one is annihilated and perishes with the breakup of the body and does not exist after death? If Yamaka were to ask you, what happens to an enlightened one with a breakup of their body after death, how would you answer? I would answer that the body is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering, dukkha, and what is dukkha has ceased and passed away. Experience is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Perception is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Will is impermanent. Sankhara. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Consciousnesses are impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Good, Yamaka. Good. It's a very clear sutta. Do you look an enlightened one, a Buddha, as inside of these khandhas, as identical with them, separate from them, without them? And none of those questions have a positive answer. You keep on saying no, no, no. So if you see a Buddha, an enlightened one, what are you actually seeing? Nothing is annihilated, it's just a process which has come to an end. Okay, if I confused you, or?
No, I just wondered about the name of that sutta.
Okay, it's Yamaka, that's how I remember it. Y-A-M-A-K-A. So if you get in your party and just get that word, Yamaka, you'll find that sutta. It says Samyutta 22.85, that's a kind of Samyutta. No. This is in the Samyutta Nikaya. 22, I think, it is the Kanda Samyutta. Any more questions? So let's go back to where I was. I forget where that is now. That's why I sometimes don't know where I was last time, because I got all over the place. But actually, I'm very happy that you asked these questions and we can actually discuss it, because this is essential for the right view and to understand it properly. Where are we gone? Okay. One right view. This one is brilliant. How to know right view from wrong view. This is what the Buddha said. After my parinibbana, complete cessation, some will think that the Dharma has ended and you no longer have a teacher. This is wrong. After the Buddha's Parinibbana, the Dharma and Vinaya will be your teacher. So you don't just need a Buddha to instruct you, you have the Dharma and Vinaya. And that's a very powerful statement. It meant the Buddha did not have to select someone to succeed him. Like when a pope dies, you have to select the next pope. A Dalai Lama dies, you have to select another Dalai Lama. And so that lineage of hierarchy and control continues on. The Buddha said, no, after I pass away, what I've taught, the Dharma and the Vinaya, that will be your teacher. That's one of the reasons why in Buddhism we don't have a leader in the sense of a person. We have the Dharma Vinaya. Now, this is also the four great standards is what comes next. Suppose someone were to say, friends, this is the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma and the Vinaya that I heard myself from the Buddha. Then you should check these persons' words with the Sutta and the Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, you should conclude that this person has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. You don't say the person is wrong. You say they've wrongly understood it. It's not a personal sort of complaint, it's just they need to learn it a bit deeper. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from a community of senior monastics with distinguished teachers. Then you should check this person's word with the Sutta and Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that it is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, then you should conclude that this community has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. The whole community. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from many learned elders who uphold a tradition. Forest tradition. Another tradition. The Siam Nikaya. Or the forest monks of Burma. I heard it from many learned elders who uphold a tradition. Then you should check this person's words with the suttas and the Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, then you should conclude that these elders have wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from one learned elder. Then you should check this person's word with the Sutta and Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that it is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and Vinaya, then you should conclude that this learned elder has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. So the Buddha mentioned that just to make sure the final authority is not some learned monk or nun or authority or professor at university or a whole group of monks or professors or nuns, but the final authority always has to be the Sutta and the Vinaya. And that's why we teach this. Yes, go on.
Ajahn, at that time, since it was the Mahasangha monastics who held the Vinaya and the Sutta, no, I mean, it was not written anywhere, it was not on internet or anything, I mean, it was just word, you know, mouth to mouth.
Yeah.
And therefore, I'm a bit surprised why the Buddha didn't mention the Mahasangha as the representative or the carrier or the courier, something like that.
Indeed, because even in the time of the Buddha, some members of the Sangha had some really strange views. So he wanted to make sure that the Dhamma Nivinaya was going to be more powerful than any other monk or nun.
Yes, but how do you access it?
How you access it? Because we do have this large collection of suttas and also the Vinaya, the training, because even in the Vinaya there's some amazing suttas and amazing teachings in there.
Yeah, that is now, but I'm talking at that time.
Yeah, but what it is became the repository for the teachings, and those are to be trusted, because other monks might come up and they may have great ideas, and I say that what we see in today's suttas is not the authentic suttas, that they have been changed in this way or that way. And even today many people wonder, how do we know that those suttas and Vinaya, which we have in our libraries, which we have online now, how do we know that that's actually what the Buddha taught? That's one of the reasons why Ajahn Bhumali and who else was involved in this?
Sujato.
Did this wonderful project called the Authenticity Project. And I really encouraged him with this, and I tried to give as much support and influence as I possibly could. How do we know that what's actually in those suttas is authentic? And there's a lot of very powerful arguments to say that these can be supported with all those arguments. So these are pretty authentic. One of the arguments is that if you read these suttas in many different recensions, even from different traditions, you find there is part, well, most of it, 80-90%, is always repeating the same things. There is a consistency of the message there over even many traditions. And that consistency of the message and so many different versions of that same sutta also coinciding gives a sense of some things in the Buddha's teachings, you know, like Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, meditation. Those parts of it are consistent, and they come across so many times in the suttas, page after page after page. The repetition gives it more of a sense of authenticity.
Thank you, Ajahn.
So that means the suttas and the Vinaya, you can pretty much look at those as an authentic, powerful, consistent document of the word of the Buddha. Yeah, go on.
In the last section when we're covering the Yamaka Sutta,
yeah.
It was one of the examples where you're using the translation of the word Sankara as will.
Yeah.
As will. And so I just wanted to ask you to comment a bit. Is that okay? Just to digress a little bit. In a lot of descriptions of Sankara I've seen, there are lots of different components of it, and one of them is will, chanda, that's used. Or there's adimokkha, which is kind of decision, which is kind of similar. Like if you're driving a car, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be willpower is going to kick in, but it's going to relax. So it's sometimes there and sometimes not. But you're using it as like a global translation for all of Sankara. But it seems to include things like jealousy or desire or metta, or lots of things can be within Sankara, only one of which seems to have this willpower part.
No, I'm just looking for
Yamaka.
The reason why I translate it as will. And I must admit, I always like the idea of calling it will. But the inner suttas, where has it gone? Sorry? Page 28. Excellent. Where is that? See if we can find it there. We have the reason why I translated as well. Not because of my what I would like it to be. Sorry? Where? No, that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the definition of will. Sankara, he calls it Chetanakaya. The body of Chetana, not Chanda, as will. Yeah. Will, Chetana.
Intention is only one aspect, isn't it? You've got attention, intention, willpower, decision. They're all under
Chetana.
Sankara.
Yeah, but Chetana, that is another form of will.
But it's only one small component of Sankara.
Oh no, that's the main thing. That's why I'm trying to find that translation for you. The definition of it. We have it here somewhere. If I was smart with this. I'll be able to get it more quickly for you. But one of the things which the Buddha said was Kanti Paramanta Potitika. Patience is one of the highest virtues. I was looking for this morning, I could see it very quickly. Where have you gone, Sankara? Chetana. Oh, here we go. This is on, it's up further than I thought, on page 10. You got even the word Sankara. Matter doctrine. No, not yet. A bit further up. Three warnings. Oh no, three characteristics of existence. A bit further up, I think. Yeah, above that. We're getting close. There! Sankara. What is the Sankara component of existence? The definition of Sankara is the six types of will, Chetana, Kaya, will involve with the objects of the six senses. When you call it Chetana, Chetana is very much the word will. Which is why even in dependent origination, the word Sankara is usually defined as the volitional activities. Volition, will. Are you happy with that?
It's with the six, but I thought we were saying earlier on the six kinds of vijnanas. Are the ones that are involved with the six sense doors?
Yeah.
Or five.
The six senses.
The sixth one. Was
and vijnana is part of the sensory experience. You know, the definition when something comes in front of the eye and the eye is intact and there's contact, yeah.
But of the five aggregates, isn't that like the fifth one? That's vijnana. And then you've got a separate one which is called sankhara. It's not the same thing.
Yes, I know, but there's also those six sense objects, is like even rupa, and you've got vedana and sanya. So sankara is part of that. But I love the way that the Buddha translates this as the six types of chetana.
So with things like the emotions, like anger and jealousy and restlessness and doubt, where would they feature? Because they're not, they wouldn't have a space for that in them?
Of course they would. Those are the same invade and experience.
You'd put those in Vedana?
Yeah, but I'd also, you don't have one sort of pocket which fits everything. The life, even the body, it has consciousness, it has perception, in the sense of, you know, those parts are necessary for the body to survive. So these ways of putting existence into these five categories, they do include everything, but there's also overlap, and there's also things which we call like emotions, which will overlap many of the five khandhas. They don't fit neatly into one khandha and not other khandhas.
I've seen a version where they do that, so it's, I'll have to reconcile that difference.
Okay, yeah. Abhidharma tries to do that. But you can't really do that because one khandha can't exist without other khandhas. One khandha, one component of existence can't really exist without other components of existence. Yeah, that's where the Abhidharma starts to come in. And you know what the Buddha said, that you check it out with the suttas and with the Vinaya. And that's one of the reasons why if you check the suttas and the Vinaya, you don't see any mention of the word Abhidhamma. Yeah?
Ajahn, that on the previous topic, that authenticity of the
teachings,
if I may ask you that somewhere, I think it was Great Arahant Venerable Sariputta who mentioned that the whole Dhamma can be put into the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
So would you say if anyone's teaching is outside the Four Noble Truths, then we can say it is not the authenticity?
You can say that, but you can, you know, take it even further and find out what they say. Is there anything in that which you can find in the suttas or the Vinaya? Anything which you can support it? And at this point, you know, I will invoke just words of advice which I got, which I've told you many times before, from Venerable Nyanaponika before he passed away. And he said you should never interpret the whole mass of repeated teachings in the suttas and Vinaya. To reinterpret that in line with one or two ambiguous passages in the sutta or the Vinaya. You should always interpret the ambiguous passages in light of the clear multiple passages. Because sometimes, you know, we have, especially what we call poetry over in Pali. And poetry, if ever you try to translate Pali, always uses some weird forms. And I often just quote things like, you know, William Wordsworth, "I wandered lonely as a cloud," which if you read that as verbatim, means that he could levitate. And of course he never meant that. You were just trying to create a feeling, an emotion, an inspiration. And some of the words which you use in the verses, you know, sometimes if you want to try and make those specific, instead of inspiration, what's the word when, I forget the language now, when you want to make these like specific instructions or specific descriptions rather than something to evoke inspiring emotions. Sometimes you can interpret some of the Buddha's teachings in a totally new way. But a good example of that is, you know, you got, just comes to my mind, one of the causes for being a stream winner is paratogosa, the words of another. I remember just one person read that and said, oh yeah, of course that's right. You need the words of God, you know, to be able to inspire you and hear the sweet sound of Jesus or something. And so they can have a word like that, which is a real word, paratagosa, but don't realize that that is very well explained as the words of another Aryan. Go on.
The most unambiguous part is the Four Noble Truths.
Yes.
So if, I think it is in the Mahahattipadopam Sutta.
Yeah, good.
It's there that you can put the whole Dhamma into the Four Noble Truths. So if it agrees with Four Noble Truths, then...
It's pretty good, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, no, no, no. You're saying that the Buddha's teaching can be summarized in the Four Noble Truths. Because he says his teaching is about suffering and the ending of suffering that covers the Four Noble Truths. No? Mm. From can I just say, from my analysis, the teaching, no? That's the general, you know, like a Four Noble Truths covers, okay? But the heart of the Buddha's teaching is in the four foundations of mindfulness. It involves our suffering, it involves our thoughts, our emotions, you know. Our emotion, you know, okay, from our thinking and the situation, and oh, that situation, you know, like it happens this thing, and my mind was harping on it, and then they give me the negative feeling. That is the main thing we should be all working on, you know. That is the heart, the core of the teaching, you know.
Yes.
You know, follow through, it's just, yeah, it's the whole thing, you know. You understand? That's what it said, but for my teaching, that is to deal with our feeling, our emotions, our thoughts. Why do we feel, why do we suffer? That's the
indeed. So you cannot just limit.
Am I wrong? Am I right?
Not quite.
Okay.
Not quite. So it's a no. Because you need a full Four Noble Truths. And even that's this Fourth Noble Truth. You see, even Satipatthana, it's reliant on what goes before, even the right view, the right motivation, the sila, and also this restraint. Because part of Satipatthana, as you've heard me say so many times, every one of those Satipatthanas relies on you already having vinaya loke abhija dominasan, which if you've weakened the five hindrances, if you haven't weakened those five hindrances, when you do satipatthana, you actually don't see clearly what your body is doing, how your mind is reacting, what feelings are. And we get conditioned just by our past ignorance, delusion. But it's only when we have restrained those five senses, have we mindfulness strong enough, even enough, we're not going to see what we want to see. We're not going to see what we don't like seeing. We see deeply into things. That's why restraining those five hindrances is so important. Only then can we really see Dhamma. We can understand suffering. And only when there's an understanding can we let go of it.
Is that related to the... They said two ways. One is satpat, one is vipassana, one is samatha. Are you trying to...
Those two differences, they're just not valid. There's not two ways to enlightenment, go samatha or vipassana. Sometimes you may say that there's those two ways to become a stream winner. But once you become a stream winner, one is strong, the other one is weak, they both have to be there. But from being a stream winner to being fully enlightened, that is where you have the whole Eightfold Path. You can't just have insight without the stillness.
What is, I know what you mean exactly.
Yeah.
But outside, there's two ways, but they always, Samatha, you'll be arguing that that's your only.
Yeah, you do need both.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm.
And if those of you who haven't heard it before, I'll finish off here because It's been a lovely session, but we've gone over and backwards and forwards. Those are the simile of the two messengers. And those two messengers, even though the Buddha, I just mentioned it in a sutta, and it's fully explained in another place, about the king who had a son, he wanted to teach him how to be a good emperor when the king died. So he sent his son off to a bordering kingdom and gave him full authority there, so he could learn, you know, on the job of how to rule a little kingdom. And of course, after about 6 months, the headman of that region sent a delegation to the emperor saying, your son is just partying all the time. He's not doing any ruling. It's not working. So the emperor sent a wise minister to teach his son how to rule. And as soon as the wise minister came to see the king's son, the son said, no, go away. This is my territory. I'm not listening to you, but I come from your father, the emperor. I don't care who you come from. Get out. And so the wise minister had to go back and report to the emperor, your son's not even listening to me. And the emperor said, I made a mistake. So he sent the emperor next time together with one of his fiercest generals from the army. So the two went together, the general and the wise minister. And when he arrived at this region, the prince, you know, the king's son, saw the minister and said, look, I already told you to get out of here. I'm not listening to you. This is my region. And at that, the general went right up to the son, put the sword to his throat and said, I've also been sent by your father. Listen. And with a sword at your throat, it's amazing how much you're listening. And said, yes, I'm listening, I'm listening, I'm listening. And then the wise minister was able to instruct the son about the pleasures and also the duties of leadership. And then the son became a good little prince and eventually took over the whole empire. And in that simile, the Buddha said those two messengers were insight and stillness. Stillness will hold you still so you can see clearly and know accurately what's actually going on. You're not just seeing what you want to see. So that's the Buddha simile there. There's no such thing as vipassana without samatha or samatha without vipassana. You do need both of them. Oh, here was the next Saturday, yes?
You said that parinibbana, the lower sea is transformed into luminous, boundless, silence?
No. I would say that when the five khandhas cease, that being ceases. The process ceases. Nothing gets annihilated, but there's nothing left. The ending of things.
Because I think I read one of the suttas that somebody was inquired where does the four elements find your support? You say that luminous, silent, harmless.
Ah, that particular passage is a great example of what I was saying earlier about something which was poetic, which was inspiring, but used words and language which are not that common. And as Venerable Jnanaponika told me, and I think it's very good advice, you interpret that in light of everything else which has been said in the Pali Canon. You don't just interpret the rest of the clear teachings of the Buddha in light of, it appears similar in two places. When it takes a luminous mind, that luminous mind, you experience that in the jhanas. That's where the hindrances are ceasing. That is not the end of all beings. It's not where the Buddha goes. When the Buddha ceases, he ceases. that Yamaka Sutta was mentioning that the Buddha was just a process. And Yamaka was, Sariputta said, what actually is the Buddha? What actually is your consciousness? What actually is it? And then you see it as just a process. Cause and effect. Arises as one thing, ceases as something else, and eventually ceases altogether. Said it like a flame which goes out. Flames don't go annihilated, they don't go to the ground of all flameless.
Energy of flame will always be there.
No, it disappears.
But the energy?
Yes. This is one of the nice things, okay, you got me going back into my science now, theoretical physics. I remember just giving a lecture with Professor Blair. He was the head of physics at UWA some years ago. And I was just saying, just stuff, matter, and the energy associated with stuff. There is something which we call negative energy. I don't talk about something psychological, but physical. Any matter within a, say, a gravitational field has negative energy. To take this computer and send it out into space to be totally free of the Earth's gravity, you have to take up quite a bit of energy to do that. So this has a negative energy component as well as a positive energy component. You know, the mass and also the energy. So I said, what would happen if all the matter in this universe with the energy to it could all come together into a spot, not just part of it, but the whole lot. Would it be possible that the positive energy of mass energy and the negative aspect of mass energy would all cancel out to zero? And remember, that's when Professor Blair turned around and said, wow, you're really up to date. And apparently there is a number, or a digit, a Greek digit, an omega. He said, omega equals one. The amount of negative energy in the universe and the positive energy of the universe, if it all did come together, would totally cancel out. And I thought that was kind of beautiful. You can't create energy, you can't destroy energy. You can divide nothing into two types of energy. They come together again, and the energy's gone. Nothing left. And that's a good time to finish. Nothing left. You can ask afterwards, Eddie, because the car's already here. And I do have a guest from Canada who's come and is waiting for me over in Bodhinyana. Thank you. Actually, where do we finish here today so I can remember for next time? No, that was just going forward. Where do we finish? Oh, no, sorry, I've got to go now. This took all the time. We can't do any questions from overseas. I ran out of time. So if you really want to enjoy this sutta class, please come. You can still come. There's things like aircraft. Okay, where do we actually get to? Okay, we haven't. I better find out exactly where. Page 19, okay, just. Crikey. When did it started right for you? How far did we get? How many learned elders? That's right, so next week is wrong view. Fortnight, yeah. Okay, crikey. If it takes all that time just to do right for you. I can understand now where sometimes Ajahn Bhamali spends weeks and weeks and weeks just doing the Brahmajala Sutta. Actually, it was a whole year, wasn't it?
I was Amanda
Garrett when it started. Okay, so we can do next. Okay, wrong view and right view. Okay, so now we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we can go. It's almost, yes, 4:30 already. Goodness.
Avaham Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantam Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangang Namami